history impels us to ask the big fundamental questions that lurk in the background of our day-to-day practices.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, I can't count the number of episodes in which we've discussed some cash transfer program somewhere in the world. But today is different. We're going to take a step back and we're going to talk about the big picture and the long view of those cash transfers. Ugo Gentilini is the lead economist for social protection at the World Bank, and his new book, launching today, is called Timely Cash. It investigates the surprisingly long and rich history of cash transfers, and it helps us understand the current, sometimes heated debates about why, when, and where they should be used. And Ugo's here now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Ugo.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
You point out in a very surprising statistic that there are now literally millions of papers on the topic of cash transfers. Why, given that, why were you inspired to write a book? What can you add to the story?
Yes, indeed, Tim. There are about 1.4 million papers written on cash transfers in the past 40 years. That's amazing indeed.
Yes.
Overall, they are positive about the effects of these programs.
Mm-hmm.
So this begs the question of why is there still so much controversy around these interventions despite positive evidence? Why do we seem to debate the same issues over and over? I soon realized that for me to better understand present debates, I needed to better educate myself on where these debates come from. And perhaps, I wondered, others may have faced similar issues in the past, and I was curious to learn how they were handled then. So I searched for antecedents of cash transfers, and to my surprise, there wasn't really a global history of cash transfers per se. There is some fantastic work on particular countries or specific periods, but I was looking for something that transcended a particular context or historical juncture. An analysis that would go back as much as possible in time and be as comprehensive as possible in terms of geographical coverage. I couldn't find it, and I set out to pursue it myself. I moonlighted and worked on this project for over 5 years, and I see my book not as the culmination, but just as the beginning of a lifelong exploration.
And when you look at what's in the book, you can see why it took 5 years. You've gone all the way back, and you've traced the story from the very first cash transfers to today. Does that make it primarily a history book?
Well, first, let me say that I really stand on the shoulders of giants.
Uh-huh.
During the process of writing, I discovered many new heroes. I am profoundly humbled by the work of hundreds of scholars in history, economics, sociology, mm-hmm. anthropologists. So the book is not just about history per se, but history examined through the lens of different disciplines, which I attempted to fuse into a global narrative. I think that learning from different disciplines helps us better understand the world around us and better explain our evolution. And in a way, the book is about the human condition in the past and today.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, history features prominently. We sometimes think of history as something detached from today's reality. What, after all, can some dusty books tell us about contemporary quandaries? Well, instead, I have come to understand history as something awakening and thought-provoking. It impels us to ask the big fundamental questions that lurk in the background of our day-to-day practices. History doesn't just explain the present, it also questions it. And this is important because reimagining the future starts with challenging the present. Then history doesn't give us a crystal ball to foresee what's next, but it does shed some light on the long-term forces that drive change. It illuminates a broad trajectory and offers some clues for navigating the uncertainty that comes with the future.
And in this case, there is a lot of history. I hadn't really thought about it, but I just imagined that cash transfers, well, maybe they went back a few hundred years. You investigated and found out that it is a lot longer than that. Did it surprise you what you found out?
Yes, it was honestly stunning. Not only the sheer number of cases, but also how closely they resembled modern practices.
Yeah.
And the more I dug into it, the more examples popped up, like I was venturing into an unexplored gold mine where treasures appearing left and right. And then after having explored this gold mine with all its rich diversity in provisions, I became fascinated by what appeared to be some recurring patterns in design and debates. And Tim, this journey really strengthened my sense of purpose. It revealed that all of us working on social protection belong to a much larger community that stretches over millennia. We are the final tail of a long tradition of passionate researchers, policymakers, practitioners that have thought hard and lived the very debates and dilemmas we face today. The book, it's in a way an extended family picture where those that preceded us are passing us the torch and share some insights into their experience.
Well, this family tree goes back, 2,500 years? And as you say, you can see how many of these cash transfers in the past are recognizable as the sort of policies that we have now. The arguments that we have now, do you find those in history as well?
Take what's happening today in Alaska as an example.
Right.
At times, there have been calls for a referendum to decide about the future of its yearly universal cash transfer program. And it turns out that this mirrors what happened in the 480s BC. Or 2,500 years ago in Athens, where there was a similar universal cash scheme operating in the city. And then suddenly a new silver mine was discovered and a debate ensued on how to use the newfound proceeds. So a referendum was called to settle the matter. And on one hand, there was Aristides who championed the continuation of cash transfers. On the other hand, there was Themistocles who wanted to divert resources to the navy instead. And alas, it didn't go too well for Aristides, who lost a popular vote the moment captured in the book's cover. But the fact that one of the first referendums in history was on cash transfers tells us how much the issue is ingrained in our society. And we're just out of a global pandemic where cash transfers reached 1.4 billion people. But it turns out that such programs were used in pandemics already in the 1500s, like in the case of Venice. And there are striking similarities in program design over time, for example, in terms of assessing household needs or establishing eligibility criteria, are often around the idea of being or not being able-bodied, a concept that goes back to the Roman Empire, or deciding whether and how transfers should be conditional or whether to choose between cash and income transfers. Conditional cash transfers didn't start in the 1990s. They were already present in the 1700s Germany as condition to education. Mm-hmm. And there is evidence of cash provided conditioned on children vaccinations in Florence in the early 1800s. And around the turn of the first millennium, Tim, China had an incredibly sophisticated housing registration system that ranked the rural population into 5 welfare categories and the urban households into 10 categories, and then provided assistance to the bottom 40% of those rankings, which mirrors how a number of low middle income countries are using their social registries today. And I have devoted 2 chapters showing how modern claims that cash transfers can create dependency or generate other negative impacts have been present throughout all those years. And I revisit how these claims were carefully contested by studies that started to appear more in modern times, including around the 1930s, and that are consistent with most of the studies published today.
So one of those long-running debates, and we've already alluded to it, is that debate over whether cash transfers are responding to something structural or whether it's something personal about poverty. Why is it so important to have this debate and to recognize it?
I dedicated a full chapter on this issue because cash transfers are often provided as a response to poverty. And here I refer to poverty not in narrow monetary terms, but in terms of wider deprivations and capabilities. But of course, there is a lot of debate on why poverty exists, how it perpetuates itself, and what to do about it. And depending on how you think about poverty, whether poverty is mostly the result of individual shortcomings or whether it has to do with structural imbalances in society, or something in between the two poles, then your views on if and how cash transfers should be provided can vary enormously. And it is fair to say that for a significant share of our history, and in several cases still today, poverty has largely been framed as a result of the fault of the individual. Mm-hmm. And if poverty is framed that way, if poverty is your fault, the scope for cash transfers becomes more limited, narrow, and stringent. So the implications are threefold. First, if the design of cash transfers has been an expression of how we think of the poverty problem, then to change the design, say that you want to pursue larger scale programs, you don't just need more money, you probably need a different poverty narrative too. Mm-hmm. Second, in being explicit about where cash fits into a poverty narrative, we can set expectations right. There are some problems that cash can solve, while others not. It helps in calibrating the level of ambition and integrating cash transfer into a wider policy framework to address the various parts of the poverty problem. And finally, a historical perspective makes us think about the big questions on whether poverty is something solvable or is it something inherent or even necessary for the way our societies are organized. So some see the provision of large-scale cash as a foundational shift in power relations. Others see it as a band-aid that leaves the fundamental poverty drivers unaffected.
Another one of those long-running arguments. You don't have to scroll very far on social media to find someone talking about it even today, is people saying that cash transfers are causing the problems. They're not solving these problems. How long's this debate been going on?
For a long time, Tim, unsurprisingly so. Look, the issue was present as early as the year 382 in Rome, when the distinction between those able to work and those unable to do so started to be legislated and assistance provided accordingly. Basically, the point was, don't support people that are physically able to work otherwise in an attempt to help. You inadvertently hurt them by making them lazy. And more recently, some of the founding fathers of economics and other leading intellectuals of the 1700s, 1800s had opined extensively about cash transfers. Not much Smith, but others like Malthus and Bentham. They weren't exactly supportive of cash assistance. They thought that cash would corrode the character of people in a way that made them indolent or improvident. Mm-hmm. The famous report of 1834 that marked the new poor laws in England was an ideological statement of this school of thought. And this goes back to how we think about poverty, what we just discussed. And the dominant framework of the time was that cash would remove the fear of scarcity, that hunger was the spring of industry. So people needed to live in a state of economic insecurity to assure a steady supply of labor. And this was sometimes couched in benevolent terms that denying assistance or providing scant support was ultimately in people's best interest. Albert Hirschman codified this criticism into what he called the perversity thesis. But despite the vast revisionist evidence showing that cash was a response to a problem, often that of unemployment or underemployment, and not the problem itself, this mental model of cash helping in the short term, but being eventually harmful if provided more generously or over protracted period of times, has proved to be very resilient. It's extraordinary how these ideas traveled over time and shaped approaches from England to India in the 1800s to Africa in 1920s, in the US in 1980s and 90s. And as you said, Tim, today there is no shortage of examples of this mindset persisting.
You categorize cash transfers three ways in which they've been employed. The first one you described as economic transformation, helping economic transformation. So when I hear that, I think of industrialization and the move to cities. Is this that sort of transformation, a relatively recent process?
I think that with the industrial revolution, this economic role has become more visible and deliberate. Take the concept of labor reserves. The story is basically one that involved a security exchange where people were giving up land, and not necessarily voluntarily so, as core source of security and moved to cities. And hence, they needed another form of security to keep them there. And with the ups and downs of the business cycle, cash transfers played an important role as a sort of security and in keeping the labor force close to industrial areas in England in the 17th and 1800s. And cash transfers also cushioned workers in major structural transition. For example, in less than a century, in the early 1800s, the Belgian city of Antwerp switched from being a premier manufacturing center to a commercial hub driven by its international port. This created growth, but not jobs.
Yeah.
And cash transfers played a major role in sustaining precarious workers and managing the labor market disruptions of this transition, including reaching about 40% of the population in 1848. Then there is another mechanism that is at play in terms of economic transformation, and that relates to how cash transfers play the role in transition both within and between economic models. We often assume that with the birth of social insurance, cash transfers became residual. And I would say, well, actually, yes and no. Looking at both the Western experiences and the socialist Soviet period and Mao's communist China, it's very clear that cash transfers kept playing an important role within those systems. Child benefits in the Soviet Union and even the five guarantees cash transfer program in China that was introduced around that time, it still lingers nowadays as has influenced modern programs. And finally, there has always been, Tim, this attempt by policymakers to facilitate and encourage some level of economic inclusion.
Yeah.
The idea that poor people could be organized in a way that could be productive and in line with industrial principles was very much alive in the 1600s up to the 1800s. The experience of Bristol, Florence in Napoleonic times, Toulouse, Hamburg, Munich, Elberfeld, which gave rise to the so-called scientific charity by using tools on poverty maps, ascertaining deservingness that we still use nowadays. They were part of that effort. But the problem then was that there were all these conflicting principles, like you had to adopt market principles and help this organize poor people and help them to produce, but also that production should not be in competition with the private sector. There were cost recovery principles. This has to be sustainable, but the quality of the produce wasn't that great. And in a changing landscape of growing urbanization, the model collapsed and a more punitive model emerged where the more classic workhouses became vehicles for correcting the character of poor people instead of integrating them in the labor market.
Yes, I walked past one of those poorhouse buildings on my way to doing this interview. It's about 5 minutes down the road, still standing as a monument to this. Secondly, you talk about transfers as a way to help build the state. This mechanism hadn't occurred to me. How does this work?
There are many ways of slicing the pie, but I frame the broad theme of building state capabilities in three buckets. First, it's very clear how much cities and states and countries have strived to ensure food security and the role that cash transfers play within such function. When we think of supplying food, we think of granaries, in-kind distributions, and food subsidies. And in fact, all these were present extensively in many societies across over history. But within them operated also less visible system of cash transfers. India had a system of pre-positioned food and cash transfers for drought response already around the year 250. The inscription of Sugaura and Mahastan, they both showed the way in which the early practices in crisis response did rely on cash too. The granaries that were present in China since the 200s not only provided the registration targeting system that I already mentioned earlier, Tim, but were also complemented by the collection of weather data to inform famine relief response and a system of so-called poorhouses that gave differentiated cash transfers to the elderly based on age. And in the Roman Empire, besides the famous food subsidies, there was a little-known permanent cash program called Alimenta. This included child benefits that were operational in at least 46 towns in the Italian peninsula. And the program was launched in the year 100 and was financed progressively according to land size. And I went myself and visited personally the Alimenta registries, which are these huge bronze tables that included details on program participants. It's quite amazing. Then I would say that there is a whole function of crises that are somehow catalysts for instituting longer-term cash transfers. And here are brought to bear various case studies and illustrations. For example, the US started to give cash transfers to veterans and widows already during the War of Independence and the Civil War. Oh. And these provisions gradually evolved into a system of protection against age. NGOs in the US were some incredible innovation incubators. When we think of the 1930s, we think of the Great Depression, we think of public works, but actually there was a huge amount of experimentation in replacing in-kind transfers with cash. And this happened across 10 American cities, reaching 1.6 million people, and with research protocols on cost effectiveness, on people preferences, that very much echoes what we do nowadays. And I looked at cases of drought and famine responses in India and Africa with countries like Botswana that formed its core model of social protection provisions, largely building out of drought responses. And finally, I think there is a whole set of experiences around building state capabilities in context of protracted adversity. And here I examine the colonial influence on cash transfers in select low and middle income countries and the process of diffusion of some form of cash transfers initially among settlers, like in Jamaica in 1682, and how in some cases these early provisions eventually shaped the institutional framework that and the core models of later transfers up to our times.
The third category that you put cash transfers into is to achieve stability. Is this stability as distinct from, I don't know, a concept of social justice or redistribution or equality?
Also in this case, I examine the issue of social and political stability in three ways.
Yeah.
First, I looked at the moral foundations as one of the founding pillars of cash transfers. And here I explore the role of spirituality, of religion, in shaping if and how cash transfers are provided. Christian approaches to deservingness. When I assume that the Catholic approach to cash transfers was to be indiscriminate, you know, you have to help as many people as you can. But actually, I discovered that around the 1100s, there was a whole set of protocols called summae in Latin, indicating actually who should receive assistance and why and how, a whole level of prioritization based on Christian principles.
Oh.
Luther's efforts for collecting funds for cash transfers via a church chest are well documented. And I came across also these fascinating debates on cash transfers between secular and ecclesiastical authorities, as epitomized in debates like Robles versus De Soto in 1500 Spain, or Chalmers versus Allison in 1800 Glasgow. And also Islam has a long tradition with cash transfers, starting with the Caliphate of Omar in the 1600s that did have child benefits and a social registry. And then I framed this idea of social stability also in the sense of ensuring social order.
Mm-hmm.
And here, there is this recurrent problem, this recurrent issue of the crisis of cities facing the influx of large number of dispossessed and mobile populations. They didn't know how to handle it. And they started banning and apprehending those that were asking for cash. There were corporal punishments and branding with fire. There were forced works. There were deportations. At some point, many cities decided that, well, actually, maybe we should legalize it and start to issue licenses and badges. Some people that received cash transfers from the state had to wear a badge on their shoulder with the letter P for pauper, so just to discourage others from applying. And in some cases, actually, and that's the case of Spain in the 1500s, some cities just paid people to move out.
Mm-hmm.
That's also happening in some countries nowadays too. And then finally, there is this other third bucket of issues that largely revolve around the politics of cash transfers. And here I looked at the evidence on whether there was any effect on social stability or reduction in the discontent and riots stemming from the provision of cash. And there is also the other side of stability. It's not always about positive practices. The history of cash transfers can be bittersweet. And cash transfers were, in some cases, used to maintain social discrimination, like cash used to amplify social hierarchies by stratifying provisions according to racial and ethnic lines, as observed in colonial South Carolina or South Africa or Fiji. And finally, I looked at the politics of change with a particular case study on the so-called failed revolution, when the US attempted to introduce a guaranteed minimum income in the 60s and early 70s, and how really the US was on a cusp of a major structural change in its cash transfer system, and how that demise actually set the political narrative toward a different direction.
So one thing that comes over very clearly from all of this is that if you're researching cash transfers and you're doing a literature search, you might want to set your filters a little wider so that you don't miss 99% of the story. But clearly, when we're talking about research or policy today, we think about now, we think about one region. Can researchers and policymakers learn from these historical precedents?
I would highlight three interconnected lessons. The first one is to pay attention to the overall direction in causality. There has been this historical pattern of people getting cash, but because of structural shifts in societies, in terms of models of economic organization, or wars, or pandemics, or other shifts, needs have continued to rise. And there is a point when cash is cast from something that helps to solve the problem to actually becoming the problem itself. The narrative then is that needs arise because of cash, and therefore cash provisions start becoming more limited and stringent. And oftentimes this cycle repeats itself. The point is that a historical perspective illuminates an overall direction in causality, where cash is in most cases a response to the problem and not the cause of it. So in a way, the message for today is that you can't trust people with money. The second message is that the societal cost of not providing assistance could exceed the cost of provision. In principle, the reduction of cash transfers should be the result of corresponding declines in need. Instead, calls for reducing the welfare rolls are a constant feature in the history of cash transfers, often using a fiscal argument, and pursue whether needs are addressed or not. So what happened to ex-beneficiaries once they're pushed out of programs? Well, some could get by without support, but the majority lowered the bar of living conditions to the point where it could be hardly lowered further. And it has been argued that the retrenchments of assistance did play a role in the rise of incarceration, hospitalization, as well as overwhelming informal and civil society capacities. So the message here is that the cost of inaction or of little action can be very high. And third, don't think just of numbers. Mm-hmm. Think of stories too. Evidence is key, but often insufficient. Well-structured narratives have stuck for centuries. The 1834 report in England, which was shown to be ideologically driven and used evidence selectively, had an outsized influence on generations of policymakers and still affects directly and indirectly some contemporary narratives that cash make people lazy. And the reason is that some anti-cash stories seem logical and appeal to common sense. You know, if you get cash, work less. So the message is that while we made huge progress on the evidence front, we may have been less convincing in presenting an equally alluring narrative that posits that hope and a basic level of economic security, as opposed to economic insecurity and fear, can spark upward mobility and make people thrive.
Today's political opinions about cash transfers, they don't just make economics news, they're on the national news. Does your knowledge of the history of how this debate has gone for a couple of thousand years, does it give you any clue as to where we're going to go next with this, where this debate will land?
Well, Tim, we are just out of the largest scale-up of cash transfers in human history, which occurred during the pandemic. And if I look at the numbers, coverage is back to pre-COVID levels. And after this major scale-up, my sense is that a degree of skepticism and the classic rhetoric around cash-generating dependencies resurfacing in policy circles. And this is consistent with the historical record. Large expansions were often followed by periods of tightening the belt. The reforms that swept across Europe in the early 1500s in places like Paris, Leipzig, Bruges, Lyon, Geneva, Zurich, Toledo, or the experience of New York City in the late 1800s were precisely of this nature. Mm-hmm. Policymakers want people to work. But just like then, or like in the case of Antwerp that I alluded to, or Como in the 1400s, the question is whether labor markets will absorb the workforce or whether we will still face these bumpy transitions and persistent labor market turbulence encompassing wide shares of the population. Tim, at the deeper level, we are hardwired in separating what is a legitimate income that is earned from the labor market and separating that from much of the rest, like cash transfers, that is considered an exception from the rule. It's unearned income. But depending on how extensive or protracted these labor market disruptions are, societies have, in the past, reimagined where to draw the line between unearned and earned income. For example, the idea that the state provided cash transfers and that this would be institutionalized in England in 1601, after centuries of labor market disruptions following the Black Death, may have seemed inconceivable in the plague that erupted in the late 1300s. We don't see it yet, but if future labor markets can't pull people out of poverty or secure a decent living standard for large shares of the population, it is possible that the path would emerge where cash transfers may at some point stop becoming unearned income and instead operate as an accepted natural supplement to work earnings. It's a long-term process, but there are historical precedents to it.
Yes, there is also throughout history that idea that as soon as we fix whatever this problem is, then we won't need to do cash transfers anymore and they'll just go away. But if you look at the menu of problems now with climate change and technological change and migration, do you think the cash transfers are going to be with us for the next 2,500 years as well?
I'm not sure I'll be around for the
next book. Don't count yourself out. Volume 2.
But Tim, if we look at these accelerating trends, the need for upgrading social protection systems becomes imperative. And this includes also how we think about poverty as a societal problem and how we redefine the responsibilities between the state and the individual in a context where risks are becoming increasingly shared and globalized. And this suggests that cash transfers might be a core part of such reframing of social protection, and maybe they will be more portable than they are today, although they might be no less debated than they were historically. But the fact that there is such recurrence in debate on cash may tell us more about the nature of the poverty problem than the effectiveness of the cash instrument. If we don't address the structural generators of poverty, this recurrent pattern of cash debates may persist. But then the challenge, Tim, is understanding to what extent are these generators fixable, and to what degree are they inherent in our prevailing economic system. Is our economic model a game of musical chairs where someone is excluded by design, or can there be enough chairs for everyone willing to play? It is ironic to see that a simple tool like cash transfers is in the middle of these big, complex questions. We often hear that cash transfers are no rocket science, and I agree, because cash transfers can be more complex than rocket science, precisely because they are intertwined in these complex societal problems.
Ugo, we've run out of time, but we've only just scratched the surface. Thank you very much for talking about it today, though.
Thank you, Tim. My pleasure.
So if you want to know about universal basic income in Athens and child support in ancient Rome and everything that came after that, then the book is called Timely Cash: Lessons from 2,500 Years of Giving People Money. Ugo Gentilini, the author. It's published by Oxford University Press. You could always give this as a present to someone and say, you see, this is what I do all day and this is why I do it. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the topics we feature. And if you've enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, please tell someone about us.